From coast to coast and around the world, you're going online with Bill Alexander. Online with Bill Alexander is a guest-driven program where the topics are diverse and entertaining. Laugh and learn while you listen to one of the best hours of online radio around. Online with Bill Alexander.
Hi, everyone. Yours truly, William Eric Alexander. All my friends call me Bill, and you're online with Bill Alexander. Here at WMCK.FM, the Keysport, WLDJ, FM 107.5, Newcastle, Pennsylvania. You can also find it at us at HOFMradio.com, and we're also at Delmarva Talk Radio out of Delmarva, Delaware. And, of course, we're on Fayette TV, Channel 77 in Fayette County. So I hope everything's going fine for you on this wonderful day. Interesting program tonight because we're going to talk about history, especially World War II history. And we're going to be talking with the president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Association, the author of the book Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. And actually, it's Howard's son. And Howard's son, Steve, is with me on the phone line right now. Steve, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks a lot.
I am so glad you're able to join me this evening. So I was looking through what you sent to me about the book. Now, what year was the book written?
Actually, it was published in 2014, so it's been out a little while, but
okay.
it's still doing very well.
So what got you to write the book?
Oh, gosh. Well, growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history.
Okay.
I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas.
Oh, okay.
And he flew bombing missions over Europe, and on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down. And he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And at that time, I had no intention of writing a book. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that, organize it, learn more about it. And there were two things that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action in Belgium about his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting, which is in the book.
Okay.
And the other were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was while he was stationed in England before his plane got shot down, and those letters were absolutely fascinating. And I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew. It became my passion. And 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it, read about it, so I decided to write a book.
So explain to the audience what happened, because as I said, I watched the video with your dad that you did that you shared in 2013, and this was his 8th mission when he was shot down, correct?
That is correct.
And
yeah, it was.
How many crew members were on the plane with him? Because he had himself, his gunner, and was it two or three other people?
Well, actually, a B-17 had a 10-man crew.
Okay.
There were four officers, the bombardier, the navigator, and then the two pilots. My dad was the first pilot, and as such, the commander of the plane and the crew, and then the co-pilot. And then there were six enlisted men or non-commissioned officers who were mainly gunners. So it was a 10-man crew.
Okay. So when the plane went down, who shot it? How did it get shot down? And what happened after it was shot down?
Okay. Well, it was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany, where my dad said the plane dropped their bomb successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, flak, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused the drag on the plane, and they lost airspeed, and they fell behind the formation who was heading back to Europe to go back to their bases. and they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters. Wolves or lions, you know, coming in on prey, they attacked the Susan Ruth, and in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the 10 crew members were killed in the plane.
Okay.
And the other eight crew members were able to bail out successfully.
Okay.
But both those German Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down at the same time. One piloted by Siegfried Merrick crashed, and he was killed. The other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out, and he made it through the war.
Now, there were two people from the B-17 that survived after everything was said and done, correct? Your father came out of it. But there were three gentlemen captured by the Nazis, correct? And then there was another gentleman that was also came down that they did not get captured.
Well, yeah, of the 10-man crew, five of the crew survived and came home. Five of them did not.
Okay.
Two were killed in the plane. As you mentioned, three evaded capture for about a couple months, but they were captured by the Germans and shot. My dad and another crewman, the tail gunner,
that's it, the
Bill
tail gunner,
evaded capture, although they were not together at all.
Okay.
And then three others became prisoners of war. So something different happened to each guy.
Okay. Because the interesting thing is the three guys that were interrogated, then basically taken into the woods and shot in the back of their head, was just to think about it is just horrific. And the Belgium, there were a couple of people that Belgians that actually saw your dad who was stuck in a tree. And they actually got him out of the tree?
Yes. Well, you just covered quite a bit of ground right then.
Sorry.
The three of my dad's crew, they actually eventually met up with five other downed U.S. airmen.
Okay.
From three other B-17s. And they were hiding in the woods, being helped by Belgium partisans, members of the Belgium underground, and a Belgium collaborator told the Nazis about him, and the Nazis came with and surrounded this hut that they were staying in the woods near Chimay, Belgium, which was just north of the French border, and they captured them. They took them back into a schoolhouse in Chimay, which is actually still there today, interrogated them, and then they took them back out the woods, and they shot all eight men.
Wow. So
yeah,
how did your dad evade capture then?
Well, my dad, he was the last one out of the plane, you know, kind of being the captain of the plane. He made sure all the other crew were out before he bailed out.
Okay.
He came down in some woods in the little village of Mackinaws, which was right at the French-Belgian border. And his parachute got hung up in some trees. And as you mentioned, a couple young Belgian men came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. This occurred in early afternoon. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, held it down the tree. And they told him to stay put because they thought it was too dangerous for the Belgian for to try to move him during daylight with
okay.
the German patrols combing the area. So my dad, you know, hunkered down. And then that night they came back and got him and took him. Actually, the two Belgian men were named Henri Franken and Raymond Durvan. Took him to the Durvan farmhouse. He stayed there one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that, with those German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, his name was Paul Tilken, came and got him on a tandem bicycle and to try to take him to a safer location.
Uh-huh.
And they headed out that night, and it's kind of one of the interesting stories that's in the book. My dad had some wounds in one leg, So he can only pedal with his good leg. And they came to a hill, and they weren't able to pedal up the hill any longer. So they started. They got off the bike and started pushing it up the hill. And when they got to the top of the hill, there was this cabaret, little cafe. The lights were on. The loud music was playing. People were laughing, talking loudly. And all of a sudden, two German officers come out of the cafe with their arms around these two young girls. Uh-huh. And one of them comes up to my dad and asks him for a light for a cigarette. Well, my dad can't speak German or French at that point, and he was petrified. But Paul Tilquin, the Belgian customs officer, knew what they were talking about. He lit their cigarette, and they let him go on their way. My dad said these Germans were so drunk and so interested in these two girls, they didn't really pay too much attention to these two, you know, yokels pushing the bike up the road.
So your dad's there. I mean, he's basically MIA for 7 months. Did he try to get communication back to your mother at the time, or was that just too dangerous to do?
Well, he actually wrote 3 letters to my mother, but they never got to her.
Okay.
So he had no communication. That was really stressful on my dad. You know, here his plane was attacked. It's on fire. He has to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is. He can't communicate with the U.S. military, doesn't know what happened to his other buddies on the crew. And he's being helped by these Belgian people who are complete strangers. They can't communicate at that point because they don't know English. He doesn't know French. He has a little French-English dictionary that was in an escape, an evasion kit that he could kind of use. But and any one of these Belgian people could be collaborators and turn him over to the Gestapo at any given time. So that was very stressful for my dad. After Paul Tilquin, the Belgian customs officer, came and got him on the tandem bicycle, they took him to another place. And after that, he was moved around from place to place to place. He might stay one night in one location or maybe 6 weeks in another location. It all depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there.
What I thought was interesting is hearing your dad say that it all depended on how the makeup of the family was. If they were brave, they would keep him there, but if they were skitterish, they would move him quickly. And in my way of thinking, I would think if someone wasn't brave, they would try to hunker him down as long as they possibly could instead of risking moving him. But again, that's just a very interesting way to think about it. The other thing I thought was interesting is all depended on how much money the families had, if they were able to buy food from the black market to be able to feed not only the family, but for him. Because if they didn't have a lot of money, they could be eating potatoes for 5 nights.
That's exactly right. Because Belgium was occupied by the Nazis then, so all the food was everything was rationed, and it was pretty lean times. The bread, had sawdust put in it. It was pretty bad eating. But people had a little bit of money. They could buy things off the black market. Uh-huh. And my dad said the people who hit him were just unbelievably brave people, and they let him sleep in their bed. They slept on the floor. They gave him the majority of the food that they had. Just wonderful people. And the people who hit my dad and any downed airman for that matter were unbelievably brave people. I mean, they risked not only their lives but the lives of their family and friends, because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to concentration camps or shot.
Right.
And some of the Belgium helpers who aided my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate.
So when your dad was involved with the underground, what did he do with them?
Well, for several months, he was just hidden, going from place to place. And there were several times that he was almost discovered by the Gestapo, which are described in the book. But finally, he got tired of hiding. Word came that Allied armies that landed at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th of 1944. And so he decided to get back into the fight. Unlike most airmen, before he went into the Air Force, he was in the Army for a year.
Okay.
So he had a year's worth of infantry training and knew how to fight on the ground, and he decided to get back into the fight. So he wanted to join the French resistance, and his Belgian helpers tried to talk him out of it because it was so dangerous. He could either be killed, you know, fighting against the Germans, or if the Germans captured him, he would have been shot on the spot
right,
as being a terrorist. But he talked to one of his helpers, Amy Cools was her name. They rode bicycles over the Belgian border into northern France, and he joined up with a unit of the French resistance. They were called the Mackie. They were ragtag independent guerrilla groups located all over France. And his group had about 20 members in it, led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. And they harassed the Germans.
It sounds, and I hate to make this comparison, but it sounds to me a little bit like the TV program Hogan's Heroes to a point, because of the resistance and these people involved with trying to undermine everything the Germans did or the Nazis did during this period of time, because they were messing up communication. They were getting in the middle of things so that the Nazis could not move forward is basically what their job was, correct?
Right, right. Although Hogan's Heroes was a comedy.
Right. Well, that's what I said. I hate to make that comparison, but that's the first thing that pops into my mind when you talk about all this stuff going on. And I'm going, that sounds somewhat familiar because of their disruption of the whole thing. And that's what I hear whenever you talk about it, and also your dad talked about it in the video, that's what their goal was, is to disrupt the Germans and the Nazis, and basically just try to do whatever they can to stale progress until the U.S. or the U.S. military forces got there to actually come in and save everybody.
Exactly. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, assassinate German officers, attack German convoys, and there's a number of instances in the book that describe different encounters that my dad's group that he was with had with the Germans. They got their instructions from the British through coded messages over the BBC radio, and they were supplied by airdrops from the British. And my dad said that the information that they provided the resistance was unbelievably accurate. If they said a German convoy was coming down this road on this day at this time, sure enough, they would be there. And that was all a result of the British cracking the German code, the Enigma code, and knowing everything that the Germans were up to.
And that just fascinates me that the British had enough confidence in the resistance that they would give them those secrets. I mean, for goodness sake, they could be working for the other side and saying they're working for the Brits and actually be counterintuitive to the whole situation.
Well, that was possible. That was possible. Yeah, you're right.
So your dad's behind the lines. He's working with the resistance. He's moving forward to this. Did he ever think he was going to meet up with the U.S. forces again?
Well, that's an excellent question. Normally, when the underground came across downed Allied airmen, they tried to get them back to England through various escape routes.
Okay.
They were set up. They would go down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out, and it was very frustrating for him and very demoralizing for him. And that was another reason why he decided to join up with the French resistance. And, you know, he as I mentioned, he knew that the Allies had landed at Normandy and that they would be coming up through France after D-Day. And sure enough, one day, actually, September 2nd of 1944, 7 months after his plane was shot down, word came that there were Allied troops in a little nearby village of Trelon, France. And so he walked into town, into the town square, went up to a army major, actually was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day, and he identified himself, and they interrogated him to make sure that he was who he said he was.
Right.
And he hopped a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then from Paris caught a transport back to England, to his base, and then finally was able to send a telegram, a Western Union telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle. So that was a happy day for my mother, I could tell you.
I'm sure it was, because I can't imagine hearing these things and for 7 months fearing that he was dead, and then all of a sudden getting a message saying, no, I'm perfectly fine. I mean, I'm sure she had hundreds of thousands of questions just to ask him, because she probably did assume that he died in the crash.
Yeah, it was very stressful on my mother, because not only did she have Susan Ruth, who was 1 year old, but my other sister, Nancy, was born while my dad was missing in action. So she also had an infant baby girl. And 7 months not hearing.
Wow.
Yeah, think how tough that was. And there's a lot of excerpts from letters, not only from my father and other members of the crew, but a number of them from relatives of the crew, either mothers or wives or sweethearts, that they sent back and forth after the plane got shot down, which are really emotional. It really makes it personal. You know, trying to keep each other's hopes up, you know, praying that their loved one would come back. And five of them did, but five of them did not.
To me, it's just an amazing story to hear it. And hearing it the way you tell it, because it sounds like this was just, once you got started, you couldn't stop. You had to tell your father's stories. Now, the videos that you have online, when did you shoot those videos with your father?
Quite a few videos on my website, not just of my dad, but that are pretty interesting from other World War II veterans. But my dad was interviewed in 2004.
Okay.
That he talked about that. As I mentioned, I knew, the basics of growing up, but it really didn't become personal for me until 1994, when I've been to Belgium 6 times, and my first trip was in 1994. My wife and I accompanied my parents to the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium, and of my dad's plane being shot down. And then with my dad, I went to these various houses and farms where he was hidden, and met some of his helpers. And that's really when it became personal for me.
Well, that was just going to ask you that, is if he kept in touch with anybody from the resistance or the people that helped him, just to keep that connection, because I'm sure that they were very, very vital to his life at that period of time.
Absolutely. And he did stay in contact with the people that he stayed with for lengthy periods of time.
Okay.
And they exchanged letters, Christmas cards. And like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war.
Yes.
Until 1989, in a Belgian organization, the Belgium American Foundation, which was formed by Dr. Paul Delahaye, was created to honor and remember the U.S. troops and servicemen that freed his country from Nazi occupation. They erected a memorial to my dad and his crew in the little village of Mackinwas in 1989. And my dad and the other 3 members of the crew that were still living at the time went over for the dedication with their wives. And there my dad was reunited, physically with all those people that hit him during the war, revisited those places where he was hidden. And that brought it all back, and he started talking about it a lot after that.
And you said a lot of people that fought through World War II do not talk about it. And my grandfather was a Marine. And prior to him passing, I asked him about it. And unfortunately, I would never get any information from him because he told me that it was something that if I wanted to know about it, I could read about it, and there was enough information, he just didn't want to relive it. And I thought that was very interesting because of the time period that they went, they did a job, they came home, and they didn't feel it was necessary to talk about it.
Exactly. They were the greatest generation.
Yeah.
And they just looked at it. It's like, well, you know, everyone, you know, did their part. You know, all these guys fought. You know, I just went over there. I had a job to do. I went and did it. And then I came back and I got on with my life. You know, like no big
right.
deal.
Exactly.
Which is unbelievably amazing that they felt that. But they're so humble. And that they're just amazing men who you know, preserve freedom that we enjoy today.
I mean, I just can't imagine your dad, everything he saw and everything he did, how he kept that to himself up until, like you said, 94, and then talking about it. Because to me, just what you've told me and what I've heard, and I'm sure the book is fascinating because now you have a basis to go interview people that were also in the same situations that your dad was in. Now, a lot of the stories that your dad told, were you able to collaborate with other people that were telling the same story?
Well, yes, I have letters from a lot of the people that hit him during the war, his Belgium helpers. But I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for Dr. Paul Delahaye, who I mentioned, and Jacques Lalot. Those two gentlemen were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends.
Right.
And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that took place that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I just owe them a huge, huge debt for what they did. Dr. Delahaye died in 2013, but Jacques Lalot is still with us. And they were Jacques, the dear friend, and Dr. Delahaye was a dear friend of my dad's and me. So I was so fortunate to have so much information about my dad and his crew that took place either from my dad, the members of the crew that survived, or Belgium, members of the Belgium underground, or declassified military documents, declassified war crimes reports. So the story of my dad and his crew is all based on firsthand testimony by
okay.
the people who were involved in the events. So what I added to the book was just a lot of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it into context and give it background.
So did the people that survived the Susan Ruth going down, was your dad able to get in touch with them and keep contact with them?
Yeah, they would get together every now and then. I can remember as a little kid, sometimes they would come over to the house and I'd be playing in my room and then my parents would make me come out and say hello to Mr. and Mrs. Musial or, you know, Mr. and Mr. Daniel. But, you know, back then, you know, I was more interested in my little toys and them. But I did meet them. So they did keep in touch.
Whenever you spoke to them, were they reluctant to tell you about what happened, or was there enough time passed that they felt that they could tell the story too?
Well, I really didn't get anything firsthand in an interview with them.
Okay.
Most of the information I got from them was through memoirs that they wrote and letters that they wrote during or after the war. Or interviews. My dad's waist gunners, Joe Musial, when they went over for the dedication of the memorial, he videoed the whole thing, and they would talk. And so I have hours of this videotape that the guys would talk about what happened and what they went through individually. So, I mean, they're very, very fortunate to have that. So even though I didn't interview them personally, yeah, I have written documents or video of them talking about what took place.
Wow. You're online with Bill Alexander here on WMCK.FM McKeesport, WLDJ-FM 107.5 Newcastle, and we're streaming online at HOFMradio.com, and we're also at Delmarva Talk Radio in Delmarva, Delaware, and we're streaming online at italknet.com, and also we can be seen locally in the Fayette County area at FayetteCountyTV.org and Fayette County TV on channel 77. Boy, that's a mouthful. It gets longer every week. On the phone right now with me, I have Steve Snyder. I always wanted the program to go bigger and bigger. It just it gets more and more to say every week. So, Steve, you spoke to me before we got started this evening, and you said that you actually had the opportunity to speak with the gentleman or one of the gentlemen who shot your father's plane down.
Yes. Unbelievable. All my dad knew and all the U.S. military knew that my dad's plane was attacked by two German Focke-Wulf fighters. And that's all I knew and that's all I thought I'd ever know.
Right.
But when I was doing my research, one day my wife, Glenda, just said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? Like, it was no big deal. And I'm thinking, no, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's naive, a stupid idea.
Right.
But I, like a good husband, you know, I did what my wife told me to do. And lo and behold, I found one of the pilots, Hans Berger, who became a translator after the war. So he speaks perfect English. And he was one of the two German pilots that attacked my dad's plane. As I mentioned, Hans Berger, his plane crashed and he was killed. And actually the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans Berger down. So they shot each other down at the same time.
Okay.
And finding Hans was unbelievable. I was so excited. I'm excited just talking about it. And we've become good friends. He's the only person from the shot down story who's still living. Hans is 96 years old.
Wow.
Lives in Munich, Germany. And I've visited him a couple times over there. The last time was just this last September. We went to the Hofbräu House and had a couple Augustiner beers. And we've become good friends. And it's just one of the highlights of my life, finding him, actually.
So when you talk to Hans about the situation of shooting your father down, now I can imagine he took down a lot of U.S. planes and Allied planes, but he was able to remember the time that he took down the Susan Ruth because he was shot down at the same time?
Yes, I mean, he really can't, he doesn't remember, you know, the details. He just remembers that he attacked this B-17.
Okay.
And he was shot down and he had to bail out. And because Belgium was occupied by the Germans at that time, you know, after he bailed out, he was picked up by the Germans and then sent back to his base at Dortmund, Germany. Actually, Hans was shot down three times and made it through the war.
Wow.
And, yeah, he said it was unfortunate that they had to be shooting against each other, at each other. But, you know, that was war. He was pretty much like the U.S. airman. You know, he was a young guy, 20 years old, fighting for his country, you know, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive.
How old, and I didn't ask you this, how old was your dad when he was shot down?
Well, my dad was an old guy, relatively.
Okay.
He was 28.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, most of the officers were in their early 20s.
Okay.
And most of the gunners were in their teens, either 18, 19 years old.
Okay.
But my dad was he's considered an old guy, you know, grandpa, the old man at 28.
I find that really interesting. So was he, when he went into the service, did he enlist or was he drafted?
Well, as a result of the first peacetime draft implemented in the fall of 1940 by President Franklin Roosevelt, my dad, registered and went into the Army in April of 1941.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, you know, he was in the Army for a year. And then he got married to my mother, Ruth Hempel, in July of 41. And then Pearl Harbor got bombed by Japan on December 7th of 1941. And my mother was pretty, concerned about the future. So she went up to visit my dad over Christmas in Washington, Fort Lewis, Washington, where he was based. And then 9 months later, my oldest sister, Susan Ruth, was born.
Okay.
And so my dad was, he didn't think he could support his, new bride and little baby on the way on a private's pay in the Army. So that's when he decided to volunteer for the Air Force, where he could make some more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer.
Right. Okay.
And that's how he got into the Air Force.
And I didn't know that. So he named the plane that he was in, the B-17?
Yeah, as the first pilot and the commander of the plane and the crew, the first pilot had the last say. Of the 10-man crew, three were married, but only my dad was the only member of the crew that had a child.
Okay.
And so they a crew kind of, came together and agreed on what to name the plane. Although the first pilot had the last say, and it's very interesting about that was called Nose Art back at that time, and the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be named and painted. The Marines didn't, the Navy didn't, nor did any other country, but the Air Force thought it would help the morale of these young guys if they could name and paint their plane. And they were really creative in what they named and painted their planes. A lot of times it was a cartoon character,
right.
But more often than not, it was a scantily clad or most often a nude woman.
Right.
after all, these guys are in their late teens and early 20s and real young men, and they wanted to remember what they were fighting for.
That's
back
right.
home.
That's right. So after talking to everybody and doing your research, and that, is there a story that sticks out more than any other one?
Oh, really the things that stick out the most are, finding the Hans Berger.
Okay.
And getting to know him and becoming friends. And the next thing would be the tremendous courage of the Belgian people that helped my dad and other downed airmen. And then the bravery and courage of my father to decide to come out of hiding. He could have just hunkered down and waited for the U.S. troops to come up through France after D-Day to get back in the fight and risk his life.
One thing I
also going to Belgium and visiting all these places where that history took place, which is just, I've been in these houses, these farms, the rooms inside those mm-hmm. buildings where my dad was hidden, and to be there, 75 years later where he stayed,
right,
is pretty incredible.
What I think is interesting, and you mentioned the one time where he didn't speak French, he didn't speak German, and he runs into the two Nazis with the two women coming out of the cabaret. Did your father have other face-to-face encounters with the Nazis? Because I think what's interesting about it, for someone that did not know the language of either French or German, he was able to pick it up. And was he able to convince or confuse the Nazis that he knew what he was talking about without stumbling?
Well, one of the places, the homes where he stayed for lengthy periods of time, next door there was a young girl, 16-year-old girl named Mimi Gabriel, who could speak English.
Okay.
So they would play Monopoly, they'd play cards, they'd do crosswords, and she taught him how to speak conversational French. So by the time he hooked up with the French resistance, he could speak conversational French. You know, and that's another thing that's pretty amazing, because here he goes, well, I want to hook up with this French resistance unit. And all of a sudden, you know, he comes to this unit, and these are guys who've been fighting. You know, they're Frenchmen, Belgium, or Algerians, some of them in his group. And they go, here's this guy they don't know here from Adam. So, yeah, he had to prove himself to them. You know, they're going, well, who is this guy, this American guy that wants to join us? I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Were the people that joined, was he the only American in that group?
Oh, yeah.
Because to me, that is just amazing, because he basically had to, at least for those 7 months, had to adopt another culture and assimilate into it, so he wasn't different than anybody else, because you know how certain things are. People stick out like a sore thumb, and he couldn't do that because they would be targeted.
Absolutely. And, you know, my dad... he was 6'3", and there's over 200 time period pictures in the book, in the print book, so
okay.
You can visualize everything you're reading about. But there's all these pictures of my dad in these, you know, the Belgium and French people, and they're all come to his shoulder, so he's, you know, he kind of stuck out.
Yeah, you can't really hide when you're the tallest one in the group. Yeah, I can...
Yeah. And, you know, they gave him civilian clothes, and he wore a beret.
Right.
And after the war and throughout his life, he always liked to wear a beret. It reminded him of those times. But he did have some up-close and encounters, you know, when he was fighting with the French resistance.
Which,
as I mentioned, they were described in the book.
When he was there, and I keep hearing bicycle over and over again. Was that the main mode of transportation, that he had a bike from place to place? There were no motor vehicles. Was that because the Nazis basically removed that from the Belgian society because they wanted to be able to keep control of them?
Oh yeah. You could not own a car. Well, back then, hardly anyone had a car, you know, back in the early 40s.
Right.
Because you had to be pretty rich to have a car back then, especially in Europe. So the cars were confiscated if you were a civilian and had some, like, important administrative job.
Okay.
So most people, you know, rode bicycles.
Because
actually in England at the time, you know, that when the 8th Air Force was there, that was the main means of transportation by all these air crews was bicycles to go from the base into the little local village.
Mm-hmm. After doing all this, did you ever ask your dad if he felt that he was not going to make it back to the U.S. while he was involved at the French resistance, or did he always have the mindset that he was going to make it back home again?
Well, I think one thing, again, back at that time, most of the country had a strong belief in God.
Okay.
And had a strong faith. My parents were both strong Christians, and so they prayed and relied on God that if things would work out. So they just did what they had to do and hoped everything would work out for the best.
So I noticed that you talk about the book and you actually speak out about it. Whenever you talk about it and you do your public speaking engagements, how do people respond?
Oh, it's very rewarding, except for this year with the coronavirus.
Well, yeah.
I typically travel all around the United States going to air shows, signing copies of my book, and then do a lot of public speaking and presentations to all sorts of different groups. And as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, I'm actually past president, current president of the 306 Palm Group Historical Association. My dad was in the 306 Palm Group stationed at Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London. During World War II, there was about 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force. And it's our duty, or it's our mission as the Historical Association, and it's really my mission doing what I do, to remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought it, and to educate the public about it. Because, you know, the World War II ended 75 years ago, and it's fading in people's memory, and we cannot let that happen. The sacrifice and the courage and bravery that these guys demonstrated to, save the world, basically, from tyranny, and to preserve the freedoms that we enjoy today can never be forgotten. And that's why I do what I do.
So with the groups that come and you sign books for and that, are you noticing it's a certain age group? Because I fear, because I'm in my early 50s, and my grandfather was, like I said, he was in the Marines during World War II. My father-in-law, who recently passed away it'll be a year this June, at the age of 93, he was in the Navy, and he was involved in WW2. I can say it tonight, honest. And that because it's so far removed, like you said, 75 years ago, that the younger generations don't understand the importance of this time period.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, the generation that really do understand are people like me and you that had knew a veteran who fought in the war.
Right.
Whether it's a father, an uncle, a cousin, grandfather. But today's youth, and it's just with, technology and social media and just everything, just aren't aware. They don't teach it like they used to in school. They don't understand that the life they have today is because of those men who fought and died years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a frustrating thing, it's something that I try to do, and it's very gratifying when young people come in up to me and buy a copy of my book, and they're interested in World War II. They're interested in war and learning about history.
Where I'm sitting at right now, I am 13 miles away from the birthplace of George C. Marshall in the reunification plan, because he was born in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. And it because of that history that I have here in my area, some more people know about it. Unfortunately, the younger generations, the younger you go back, they're not taught it. And I think it's very important that we do teach it, because they need to understand where we've come from and how we've gotten into the situation that we're in now, so we never relive history. We don't go back and remake our mistakes that we had before. So I think it's a very important time period in our lives. And just hearing a story coming from your dad, who was actually there from the U.S. side, went, fought eight missions. The eighth mission, he was shot down. And yet he was able to pull himself together, was saved by Belgians, the young men who saved him, and then was shuttled from place to place before he got to do the fighting of the French resistance, is just amazing to me, because you don't hear stories like that in today's settings.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah. It was an incredible story, but the book is not just about my dad, but
right.
It's about each member of his crew and about all those Belgian people that risked their lives to help them, and about all the men who fought in the 8th Air Force, and really all the men who fought during World War II. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II.
Right.
60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. So we just cannot forget their sacrifice, and it's our duty to remember.
When you interviewed some of the people that helped your father, what were they communicating to you? Were they doing it because they felt they had to do it? Did they talk about them being fearful? Were they not fearful? What message did they give you when you talked to them?
The people who helped my father, they were so grateful. And actually, I can speak specifically for the Belgian people, but the people in the Netherlands and northern France feel similar. Is that, I mean, their countries were occupied by the Nazis and were under Nazi oppression for 4 years. And they felt, and they still feel, that it was just incredible that here you have these Americans or the British or Australians or Canadians, whoever, you know, risk their lives to come help them free their countries from Nazi occupation. So they feel such a debt, and to this day are so grateful and so thankful for the Americans or the Allies coming to liberate their country. And they do a great job of educating the younger people about remembering too, you know, much more than the United States, because their countries, they endured the occupation. They saw they went through the hardship. The people in the U.S., especially the younger generation, they've never been through any of this. They
right.
don't realize what can happen, and how good we have it. When you go to Europe, those people, they've lived through that hardship, and they remember it, and they'll never forget it.
And to me, I just cannot. I cannot fathom them living through that situation, because as you said, we have not had a battle on U.S. soil since the Civil War, and that was in such small locations, unlike what was going on through World War II, because, I mean, it was a total occupation of Europe. There was no place that was not involved in that because of the way the invasion was done. And again, having someone to be able to work together, band together, and fight the Nazis, and fight that group of individuals that wanted to reign tyranny over the world, that was a special group of people, from the soldiers from the United States to the people that were helping those guys. And they were doing it risking their lives because, again, like you said earlier, if they would have been found out, they would have been sent to a prisoner camp, they would have been either shot, whatever it is, their life would have been totally disrupted.
Absolutely. I mean, they lost every freedom that they had. And they lived in fear for 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, seeing friends and family murdered. You know, it's just hard to imagine that. Yeah, even myself, that I'm so involved in the history of it and appreciate the history of it, you know, I didn't live through that.
And again, it's
even just, I can't even imagine.
But again, it's just fascinating that you were able to take the letters from your father, the journals, and his actual recollection, not only his, but the other people you talked to put together a historical document that can share it with future generations and actually maybe start conversation with younger people to say, hey, this is what happened. And it's possible that, unfortunately, it could happen again if we're not careful.
It could definitely happen again.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
So, Steve, it's hard to believe we've been on the phone for almost an hour now. And I really appreciate you taking time to talk about the book, Shot Down, the true story of the pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. I really appreciate you doing it. The book is available at Amazon.com. I will put a link of it in the description here and of the program on the podcast. And for those of you that are listening to us on the radio, go to Amazon.com and look up Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. It will pop right up and you'll be able to purchase the book. And also you can go to Steve's website too, come to think of it, SteveSnyderAuthor.com, to find out more information.
Yeah, there's a, if somebody wants a personally signed autograph book, they can go to my website. There's a, on the homepage, you can order that. And not only is there information on my website about the book, but there's tons of information about the air war over Europe, interviews with veterans, links to all sorts of different archival footage and movies and things. So it's a great research source as well.
Well, Steve, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us this evening, and I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate it. I had a good time. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Hopefully we can talk again soon.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds like a plan.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Online with Bill Alexander here on WMCK.FM McKeesport, WLDJ-FM 107.5 Newcastle, and Delmarva Talk Radio, Delmarva, Delaware. And you're listening to us online at italknet.com. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this program tonight, and we'll see what's coming up soon.
What to expect when you're expecting a teenager.
Hey guys, today I'm going to show you how to team-proof your home. First step, hide the car keys, preferably somewhere they would never look. Did that go okay? You have to provide an outlet for their creative expression. So good. Challenges will come up. Be ready for them. Hi, honey.
Ready for the mom. You don't use mannequins in the mannequin challenge.
You don't have to know it all to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
Well, it's hard to believe it's time to wrap up another program here online with yours truly, Bill Alexander. Had a wonderful time. Again, Steve Snyder, and the book is called Shot Down, and it's a book about his father and his crew members from World War II, the true story of the pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. If you want more information, all you have to do is go to Steve Snyder Author. .com. Again, that's Steve Snyder. That's S-N-Y-D-E-R author.com. And you can also check out more information by going to Amazon, searching the book's name. It's there. And I'll put all the information in the in my show notes if you're listening to the podcast at italknet.com. Guys, I am out of here. You have a great one. We'll talk to you next time here online with yours truly, Bill Alexander.